This storm has caused confusion and delay.
You have caused
confusion and delay.
I think you are facing prejudice.
Daisy is just the ultimate thought. Daisy is just the ultimate thought.
Your impatience has caused confusion and delay. This storm has caused confusion and delay. You are causing confusion and delay. You have caused confusion and delay.
26 years old and you can't even drive? I can. Are you stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive! Be great today.
Well, hello everyone and welcome to another Deepest Lore. I'm here. I'm going to take a sip of my Coke Zero. Long-time fans will be wondering why I'm drinking Coke Zero as opposed to my usual Pepsi Max. And that is because they sell Coke Zero in boxes of 24 cans with a handy kind of cardboard holder, which you can just put into your fridge. And they only sell the Pepsi Maxes in these cheap little plastic things of 12. So I have taken to the Coke Zero instead. And I prefer cans as opposed to the bottle, because a can is a discrete unit, whereas the bottle, you know, the 2 liter bottle is chaos. That's chaos. Whereas the can is order. So that's why I'm going with cans. All right. So why not? I've already had a cup of tea today, and I fancied having a Coke. Let me tell you a little secret. In my years of doing streams, I have found that coming to a stream with a cup of tea or a cup of coffee invariably means that by about half an hour into the stream, it is stone cold, the coffee or the tea, whereas the Coke is already cold. And that is one reason why having a hot drink for a stream, especially a solo stream like this, because there's no chance really to drink it. But even on unpopular opinions, last night I came to the stream with a cup of tea and, you know, most of it was still there after 4 hours. You know, it's very difficult to drink on stream, as it were. Okay, so why are we gathered here today? Just before we get going, I will remind people to pick up the Trivium or any other course on the academic agency. In fact, I'm playing ads at the moment, so why don't we go with the writing ad?
Buy Foundations of Writing on the academic agency. To write clearly will help you to think clearly. The ability to communicate ideas in lucid prose is foundational to success in many areas, and it is a basic requirement in every walk of life. You will learn the parts of speech and come to understand the core functions of the English language, sentence construction and syntax, punctuation, style, and common mistakes. Once you see how mistakes are made, you will not unsee them. You will know for the rest of your life. Foundations of Writing. Buy it now.
All right. So, I have a little idea, by the way. Something that will be of interest to some people, but I've got an idea that I want to do a number of private screenings of Adam Curtis movies. And I was thinking of making it like a ticketed event, because I have a capacity to do something using the tools I have here. And I was thinking, if I, every single week for the next, you know, for the rest of the year, screened an Adam Curtis movie for a private audience, and then we could have a kind of seminar, a discussion after it, you know, about the film afterwards. Would people be interested in that? You know, it would be like because it's limited, I'd have to charge for it, fiver or tenner or something like that. But if that would be of interest to you, let me know. And if you know, once I see, I don't know, like 20 people are interested in doing that, I'll make it happen. I'll make that thing, you know. So, yes, that is something I'm planning, friends, and I think it should be really cool, actually. And yeah, we'll watch it. I think Adam Curtis movie is like 45 minutes, hour long. We'll watch it together, and then we'll have a discussion about it privately, you know, in this kind of private event that I'm going to run. So if people are into that idea, the idea is it's going to be every single Adam Curtis thing. So it would be a different one every single week. You know, it'll be the same time every single week, same time. And then obviously each different one would be, I don't know about like, it'd be, I'd make it nominal, like a fiver or a tenner or something. But I'd have to charge because this facility I've got has got very limited spaces. With this many people watching me, I have no way of discerning who would be able to do it. But if I made it ticketed, we could have, I could do this private screening business. So, all right. So why are we gathered here today? Well, Halloween is around the corner, as I'm frequently reminded by little AAA, who's excited about Halloween. And I thought that, I recently played a couple of weeks back, I was playing Warhammer Total War 2, I think it was. And I played a campaign as the undead, as the true Von Karstein. And it got me thinking in that about like, well, it's interesting who's included on the undead roster and who is not included on the undead roster. And, you know, I've over the years, I've played many, many different strategy games. Back in the 90s, I used to play Heroes of Might and Magic. I had a pack with 2 and 3 in it. It was like a double pack. Everybody raves about Heroes of Might and Magic 3 as being the kind of best in that series. I kind of like I thought Heroes of Might and Magic 2 had a real charm to it, kind of cartoon graphics and superb music in those games, the Heroes of Might and Magic games. But of course, there's undead in basically every RPG you can think of. Obviously, I'm a big fan of Baldur's Gate 2. There is a new Baldur's Gate. And I've heard, some people moan that it's woke, other people say it's amazing. I just don't have time to play that, I'm afraid. I'm assuming the new Baldur's Gate has got undead in it as well. Pretty much every fantasy game I can think of has undead. And I thought it would be fun to try to discern what I'm calling the definitive undead roster. So what I did is I started going through all of the major franchise games I could think of, and noting down who was on their roster. And I actually did come to, I put it all together in this table here. And as you can see, I went through D&D and Baldur's Gate. I mean, D&D basically is where a lot of the core undead lore comes from. We'll talk about that in a second. I went through Warhammer. Obviously, it was playing Warhammer Total War that inspired this stream. I went through Heroes of Might and Magic. I used to play in Warcraft 3. I used to play as undead in that. What was his name? Arthas. And I love Warcraft 3. I thought it was an awesome game back in the early 2000s there. And they had a pretty distinct undead roster, I thought. There was another kind of Heroes of Might and Magic style game called Warlords. I remember playing Warlords 3 back in the mid-90s or late 90s, whenever it was. They had an undead roster. There's similar kind of turn-based strategy game called King's Bounty that I've got the complete series of somewhere. I haven't bothered playing all through it all yet, but they've got an undead roster. Disciples is another one of those kind of games. Diablo, of course, like back in the day, the big RPGs were Baldur's Gate and Diablo. and so I put those down. I kind of ignored the Elder Scrolls games for the purposes of this. I feel like they, I don't recall if there is undead in there in those games, but I feel like they have less of a defined roster in those games in general. So I didn't put down Elder Scrolls. And, you know, I also didn't put down franchises that are based around the undead, like, do you remember Vampire Bloodlines? Do you remember that game? I mean, it was a great game. It was a great RPG back in the day, but I haven't included games like that. And there are a few others there are a few other franchises, kind of quite big ones, that for various different reasons I have simply just ignored. But these are the ones I went with for the purposes of this. Okay. And if you have a look, basically every single roster has got the skeleton and the zombies. I've broken it down into rank and file, elite units, and lords. And pretty much every single undead roster I can think of has the skeleton and the zombie as their two basic rank and file units. They're tier one, available from the start of the game, lowest tech unit is the zombie and the skeleton, always. Apart from actually in Warcraft 3, which we'll talk about that soon, I've put yes for Warcraft 3, but I'm thinking of the abominations there. There isn't actually a standard normal zombie in Warcraft, in Warcraft. And I'll when I get to the actual specific sections on skeletons, I'll talk about Warcraft then. then there are ghouls and ghosts, which was also the name of a famous NES game in America. It's called Ghosts and Goblins in this country, but pretty sure in America it was called Ghouls and Ghosts. And they are not, like, lots of games don't have the ghoul. If you notice, look, like Diablo, Disciples, King's Bounty, lots of. So we're getting into, you know, the ghoul is often missing, and the ghost is often missing. But we'll get onto them soon. Then the Wraith is almost ever present. He's not in King's Bounty, but the Wraith is there a lot. Banshee, similar to the Ghoul, often not present. The Mummy, and we'll get onto what exactly these beasties are in a moment. For the rest of the stream, I'm going to go through each one of these and talk in like autistic detail about each one of them and what their abilities are typically in these games. Obviously I don't have stats because I'm going across many different franchises, but we can talk kind of in the aggregate. We're talking in the aggregate, because basically the idea of this stream is, if we were going to make a kind of strategy game, right, or we were going to make an RPG or an RTS or a turn-based strategy game like Heroes of Might and Magic, who would be on the undead roster? And this is basically what I'm trying to figure out here. And the reason I actually came up with this stream in the first place is because while AAA was, she wanted to get this Halloween manual, which had magic paint. It's one of these things, like, you can get a book and you can color the pages in water, if you can imagine, with a paintbrush, and it kind of colors in automatically. This had a mummy on the front of it, and it made me think, don't see the mummy that often anymore. When I was a kid in the 80s, the mummy was very, very front and center in like Halloween iconography, horror, like in all the games. You know, the mummy was a standard part of the undead kind of crew, and also of the more general horror crew. Okay. Like if you go back to Hammer Horror, you know, it was Dracula, Frankenstein's monster, and the mummy. And I think there was a bit of a mummy revival when the film came out in the 90s as well. Did it have The Rock in it? Am I imagining that? I noticed that The Mummy has kind of dropped off a little bit in recent years. Funnily enough, I made a tweet about it at the time as well, when the thought occurred to me. And then I thought, wonder how often The Mummy is on the undead roster or not. Turns out about half of the time, if you look at my stats there. But actually, since I made that tweet, I am seeing The Mummy everywhere. There's like a Halloween party going on in one of the towns near here. And, you know, on all the Mummy has been chosen as the lead monster on the Halloween poster. I took AAA to do like pottery painting. We went and painted a pumpkin, and we painted like a little mug, which had a heart on it. And similarly, that was, you know, one of the things you could paint there was a mummy. So I feel like The Mummy is actually in the midst of a comeback this year. In terms of Halloween in Britain, at the very least. But anyway, you can see The Mummy is there about half of the time, slightly more present than the ghoul. The white is kind of pretty common on the undead roster. And the Banshee, the Mummy, and the white are always elite units, or at least a step up from the standard kind of tier one skeleton zombie. In any game, you would need to unlock a tech to get The Mummy or the white. You know, it would be like tier two or tier three on the tech tree. You understand? And this was also the case back in the 80s. I used to play a game called Hero Quest. I'd play as the evil wizard, and my mate would play as all the good guys. And in the undead army in Hero Quest, which I later found out is actually set in the Warhammer universe. I didn't know that at the time, but apparently Hero Quest is set in Warhammer, which kind of blew my mind. That means that Morkar the Wizard, who is the evil wizard from Hero Quest, is in some strange way part of Warhammer lore. Now, I don't know that much about Warhammer lore, but I started getting it interested in it while I was playing that Total War Warhammer game, because the locations and the map in that game are really amazing. I know Forgotten Realms stuff more through playing Baldur's Gate as much as I did back in the day. That was my kind of journey into knowing about D&D stuff, because you know, like Elminster and Drizzt and all those guys, they're in, like, they make cameo appearances in Baldur's Gate 1 and 2. And the lore in those games, you know, they're full of books and like the weaponry, and you know, there's stories and stuff that you can follow up on. So at one point I got pretty into the lore of Baldur's Gate, and then through that the lore of Forgotten Realms. I never really had that with Warhammer, but playing the Total War map, I thought, actually, these locations are pretty, this map is cool, and there seemed to be a lot of like hidden background information about every location and so on. But anyway, in Hero Quest back in the day, they had a skeleton, a zombie, and then the next tier, the next unit up, extra defense, greater attack, was the mummy. And there was a little plastic mummy piece. And then above that, you had your various lord units or whatever. So then in the elite units, you get the Bone Dragon. Now, look at the Bone Dragon. Apart from Diablo, the Bone Dragon appears basically in every single franchise. So every army needs some massive late-tier unit, some massive threat. Typically, it's like gigantic, you know, some... They don't have to be able to fly, because in some other rosters, it will be like a, you know, like a giant or like a cyclops or something. And for the undead, without a shadow of a doubt, the Bone Dragon or the Shadow Dragon or some sort of, or sometimes it's an Ice Dragon, will always be that that kind of big late tier unit. This is a tier 5 tech. Late in the game, late game kind of beast mode unit is the Bone Dragon. Always. Notice, though, how I've kept it in Elite. It's not a Lord unit. It's simply the highest of all of the minions, if that makes any sense. The highest. And usually the Bone Dragon, and this is so consistent. This is a thing that kind of started blowing my mind when I really started looking to this. The lore behind undead and the kind of characteristics of the undead units are so standard across different franchises. They are so staggeringly standard, you know, that it's almost to the point where I wonder if a major company released a game which had undead, and let's say, I don't know, the Bone Dragon was missing from the roster, whether gamers who played games for many years would start complaining, where's the Bone Dragon then? Where's our late tier unit? You know, but that never happens, because of course the Bone Dragon's always there. And the Bone Dragon will always be a late tier unit. It will be the highest tech, and it will also be extremely expensive and have high upkeep, meaning that there can only be like one or two on the map. You can't spam Bone Dragons, really. Although in that Total War game, I'm so rich at this point that I could spam. I could field an entire unit of Bone Dragons if I wanted to. They're called something else in that. They're called like Vagarists or something in Warhammer, but it's basically a Bone Dragon. Okay. So then now this next bit. You see there's that breakover between the elite units and the lords. The next two units, the Necromancer and the Death Knight, in terms of where they stand on the roster, there's some give and take here, because the Necromancer is either a very high elite unit, a kind of late tech, tier 4, tier 5 elite unit, or it's a lord. Necromancer could be a lord unit as well. Like a kind of hero. If you're playing Warcraft, it could be a hero unit, you know. But in fact, in Warcraft, the Necromancer is an elite unit and not a lord. In Warhammer, it's a lord, I think. Trying to think of some of the others. In D&D, there's not really Necromancers, because it's in D&D, really, strictly speaking, it is a school of wizardry, and it's a kind of specialist mage. It's a mage specialism, basically. So it's kind of, but I don't know, if you were designing a quest, the Necromancer in the D&D would essentially be a specialist mage who's got loads of death spells and things like that, and raise undead and all the rest of it. So, but they'd invariably be a boss of some sort, right? So yeah, it's a high tier unit. It's kind of the highest elite unit, or like, it, you know, the lowest of the lords or something like that. I mean, we'll get more onto the Necromancer soon. I'm just trying to establish the hierarchy first, and then we're going to go in tedious detail about each one of these. If this is no interest to you, by the way, you should just leave, because this is just like, there's no other content here apart from nerding out about nerd shit. This is all we're doing. It's a kind of ride the tiger stream, and that's it. Okay, so yeah, one of the things that we'll talk about later, though, is the question of whether the Necromancer is a living human who has simply turned to the dark side, or is undead themselves. And this is something that there's some, it seems to me that there's some discrepancy or inconsistency on this between different laws. In D&D, my understanding is that the Necromancer would always be a kind of, you know, a living, you know, human male or human female or whatever. But in other franchises, the Necromancer is often also undead themselves. Pretty sure that's the case in Warhammer, for example, or that in Warhammer, I think that they're so corrupted by dark magic, they've almost kind of like their flesh is rotting away and stuff like that, from what I can remember. In Heroes of Might and Magic, the Necromancer is a lord unit, and it has a skeleton face, I seem to remember. And in the Might and Magic game, like the RPG games as well. In Warcraft, I seem to remember they're humans, they're living humans. So, yeah, I mean, there's a discrepancy as to whether the Necromancer is living or undead. I would say, usually speaking, though, the Necromancer is living and not undead. But and then we have the Death Knight, who is actually, surprisingly, ever-present. You'd think the Death Knight would be more like the Ghoul or something, you know, present in some and not in others. The Death Knight is ever-present. We'll get to him later, but, you know, it's, I mean, it's pretty self-explanatory. It's an undead dude in heavy armor, possibly with a kind of blacked out face, black armor. Sometimes they're called a Black Knight. But, you know, when you see the Death Knight in a game, you know him. And occasionally, so I would say in D&D, the Death Knight tends to be an elite unit as opposed to a lord type. There'll be a sub-boss or something like that. But in other games, the Death Knight is very much the hero or the lord unit. Like in Warcraft 3, for example, Arthas is your archetypical Death Knight. And then I would say, I mean, the lord units for the undead are very standard, I would say. The Lich, which is an incredibly powerful spellcaster or wizard. And then, of course, you have the vampire or the vampire lord, ever present. Now, in some games, you get a slightly less powerful vampire, which becomes like a kind of high elite tier unit. That is the case of heroes in Might and Magic, by the way. They're just a kind of powerful flying unit or whatever. But I would say in most games, the vampire or the vampire lord is a boss, is a top of the tree, special unit, hero, etc., as is the Lich. Okay, so we will get more onto the specifics of each of these soon. Okay. And basically going through all of these, I noticed that basically D&D has all of them. And Warhammer has pretty much every single one of them, apart from the ghost. And within the Warhammer kind of world, ghosts do exist, but they're not part of the undead unit. I feel like in Warhammer, ghosts tend to be codified as kind of somebody trapped in purgatory. They could be a good character. You know, they're non-violent. They're not kind of, you know, they'd appear in a cutscene or something. They're not actually a fighting unit, whereas that is not the case in other games. But because all of these are basically present in the top two fantasy franchises, D&D and Warhammer, and they're basically more or less there in the others too, I have gone with this, the whole 13 of them, as the definitive roster, okay? So before we start on the autistic breakdown of each one of these, let me establish once and for all the definitive undead roster. It has 13 different unit types. The rank and file consists of the skeleton, the zombie, the ghoul, the ghost, and the wraith, with the wraith being more powerful typically than the other units there. That is the rank and file. The skeleton, the zombie, the ghoul, the ghost, the wraith. Rank and file. Then you have the elite units. The banshee, the mummy, the white, the necromancer, and the big bone dragon. Elite units. And then, and I would say another consistent feature of undead roster, okay, is that they have a few powerful units, a few extremely powerful units, and then a horde of disposables, right? So the a very typical feature of undead gameplay in all games is that although skeletons and zombies are fairly easy to kill or whatever, they mass. It's a horde, and they keep on coming back. So the undead horde is a great idea in terms of all undead rosters ever. It's a mass thing. So that is very typically, there's a kind of very large inequality gap in the undead roster, where the elite units and the lords are very high up and the rank and file are very low down. And there's almost kind of no, there's almost like no undead middle class, if that makes any sense. You're either a mass rank and filer or you're a very high elite unit with almost like, there's not a lot in between, if that makes any sense. So, yeah, and we'll get more onto that in a second. I mean, a very typical kind of undead setting would be like one necromancer and a shitload of skeletons. Very typical scene, I would say. Or like, you know, horde of, you know, lots of zombies, lots of skeletons, one mummy, something like that, you know. That's usually the setup. And you could go through like old kind of quest books and things, and you'll see that all the rooms are set up like that as well. You know, shitload of skeletons, couple of, you know, one banshee or something like that. That's usually how it would be. Okay. All right. So let's continue here. I found that almost all of the lore that we think of when it pertains to undead in all franchises, seems to have its roots in this book here, for the Lords of Darkness, introduced by Ed Greenwood. This is a kind of AD&D manual from 1988, I think it was first published. And as far as I could tell, I mean, obviously, the ultimate roots of all of these fantasy things are in, you know, various mythologies, Norse mythology, and you know, they take liberally from all of the mythologies of the world. Sometimes it's Middle Eastern theology, sometimes it's Anglo-Saxon or Celt mythology, you know, like the banshee I think comes from Irish mythology, for example. But in terms of codification within a fantasy universe, characteristics, traits, play style, pretty much all of it gets codified and set in stone by this book right here, Lords of Darkness. Okay? Lords of Darkness. Now, this book is disappointingly short on, like, it's very based around the actual quests. There's a set of quests, but the play style and the stats and the characteristics of each of the units are very much, I would say, basically derived from this book. Now, one of the best things I found was that on the Forgotten Realms wiki, there is a section which basically, you see all these little quotes here? All of these quotes are taken from different pages of Lords of Darkness. And I thought it would be worth... yes, Dr. Britton, there is the original Monster Manual, right? There is the original Monster Manual. But if you compare and contrast the detail in the original Monster Manual on the undead specifically, as compared with what Lords of Darkness does, you will see that Lords of Darkness massively fleshes out a kind of bare bone, rotting fleshes out, doesn't flesh out. I don't know, what's a good undead pun? It basically puts meat on the bones of what was there in the Monster Manual. Right, so I did actually go back and find the original Monster Manual. There is a mummy in there, there is a skeleton in there, and so on. Your basic kind of undead creatures are in the original Monster Manual, but in terms of detail, Lords of Darkness is really what kind of gives it to you. So, and it's got really cool artwork as well, I have to say. That artwork is cool. All right, so, yeah, I mean, in terms of the actual mythology, I find a lot of the origins of undead stuff seem to be either Norse, they tend to be European origin, and the Middle Eastern root is much more the, I mean, genies quite obviously, but a lot of the kind of like there's a separate army, right? There's a separate roster, which is made up of various kind of demons and things like that. And a lot of the ultimate roots of those types of creatures, if you trace it back, are from Middle Eastern theology as opposed to Western. So, and you can even feel it with the, you know, typically a lot of those armies will use like scimitars and things like that. So there's even a slight bit of kind of Middle Eastern coding when it comes to the kind of demon roster. So, all right. So let me just read through the origins of the undead, because once I read this, I think you'll see that even though this is quite detailed, this is all stuff you instinctively know, right? If you've been playing games and into this sort of stuff for as long as I have, you'll be surprised how much stuff you just take for granted, right? But when you really start to think about it, this is basically all undead ever, okay? So there are six basic ways that a living creature could become undead. Purposeful personal reanimation. A living creature could willingly undergo the transformation to undeath. In most cases, the creature possessed a disposition towards evil, but this was not always the case. More common reasons, including fear of dying or of old age, fear of dying from a grievous wound, and a thirst for power. And you all know this scene. It is the typical, the archetypal Faustian, you know, possibly a wizard character who is lusting for power, wants something, he's driven by, you know, his lust for knowledge, and makes a kind of communion with the undead and makes himself, you know, corrupts his own flesh and soul. You've seen the scene a million times. It is the origin story of every like major necromancer ever. And there it is right there. Okay. So that's the first way of becoming undead. Okay. Is the, is that, and I think that, you know, to come back to what I was saying earlier on about whether the necromancer is dead or alive, I think that this is what we're hitting on really, is that the necromancer was the difference between the necromancer and the reanimated skeleton, right? Is that the necromancer, even though he's corrupted his soul, was once a kind of normal man. And he's kind of corrupted himself. So he exists in this. Okay, even if he is undead, technically, he's become undead through this method, not through being reanimated, if that makes any sense. And we all, when we really start to think about it, we know the distinction between those two things. Okay. Second, we have the minions. An intelligent creature might create undead servants as a means to their own end. These mindless minions were created by malevolent spellcasters to serve as guards or otherwise carry out their bidding. And this is exactly the undead that most people would think of immediately. It's the mindless zombie, the mindless skeleton, who is held together and is only animated through some sort of magic. And this is a very, very standard trope, I would say, that if you can get rid of the necromancer, or if you can weaken that magic, maybe the skeletons, their binds will break, or they'll disintegrate, or, you know, they'll turn to dust or whatever, or they'll just fall to the floor because they're being artificially moved. And this comes with a whole host of standard tropes that you take for granted, that you know up there without it being written down. You know all of this stuff innately. But you know, for example, that the undead is immune to mind spells. It's immune to being turned using kind of mind control stuff. It's immune to any sort of almost psychological attack. It has no, because it's mindless, right? It has no brain. And these are all things that you kind of know, you know, you just kind of know as second nature if you're into fantasy stuff. Third way of becoming undead, atrocity calls to unlife. Sometimes a living creature committed an evil and heinous act that transformed them into an undead creature. The intensity and specificity of the required act was somewhat random and not entirely uncommon. So this is more... I'm trying to remember how Arthas becomes undead in Warcraft 3. Can anybody remind me? But this is more like, you know, you've meddled with the primeval forces or whatever. This is a different way of becoming undead. It is not actively chosen. It's a consequence of something terrible that somebody's done. I can't actually think of any good examples off the top of my head of this. But you know it when you see it, yeah. You know it when you see it. Unfinished business. An intelligent creature died and was killed with an important deed left incomplete. In a similar manner to atrocities, the specifications surrounding undeath achieved in this manner were often left up to chance. So this is basically like old Hamlets, if you know Shakespeare's Hamlet. It is the idea of the ghost in purgatory. He's got some sort of unfinished business. And I would say this is where the ghost is often missing from the actual official roster, because the ghost in many, many games will be a non-violent, neutral or even friendly NPC character to talk to, because there'll be a quest giver, you know, oh, I won't be able to rest until this, I get my revenge, or I won't be able to rest until, you know, I put things right, and then they can find. So it's actually a very Catholic, it's actually a Catholic theological idea that is wrapped up, I would say, with the character of the ghost. And again, countless examples. There's actually loads of those in the Baldur's Gate games. There's quite a number of kind of, you know, spirits who can't rest and all this sort of stuff. But very common trope. And you know that when you see it as well. Then somebody's asking about Mumra from Thundercat. Well, I mean, he's technically a mummy, but I would say that if he was in a game, he would actually be closer to a lich. Mumra is basically a lich, I would say, because of his, you know, huge amount of power. He's a mummy lich hybrid or whatever, a mummy who is specialized in lich activities. Or dark forces. So this is the 1, 2, 3, 4, fifth way you can become undead. Malign forces creating undead beings seemingly at random. This had the potential to befall any creature at any location and seemingly at any time. In Cormyr, it was thought that wandering evil spirits would take over corpses and use them to slay and scare the living. So this is like, you know, there's some external force making this stuff happen, which is kind of like, oh, this area is haunted, right? This whole area is haunted. Some dark magic has come over it, and it's killing all the trees and all that sort of stuff. Again, you've seen the scenario a million times. And finally, you have death by wounds caused by a nether undead. This is your basic vampire, right? Many forms of undead creature inflicted their undeath upon others when striking them with a mortal wound. Perhaps most famously, this occurred in the case of vampires and their bite. And I think that everybody recognizes that vampirism is being undead as a vampire is not the same as being undead as a skeleton or indeed as being the corrupted, evil undead of the Necromancer. Everybody recognizes the undead of the vampire is a different strand of undead. It's a different flavor, and it's a different kind of lore around being undead in that way. And one of the kind of fascinating things is the extent to which these different types of undead are part of the same roster and the same lore, or are in fact parts of different rosters and different lores. Many games actually shove them all in together, as I'm doing with my definitive roster. But I think there's a genuine question to ask, like, how much are the vampires really in league with the necromancers in general? Because there are many scenarios, because, I mean, if you think about this, right? In the classic horror setting, where is the vampire hanging out versus where are the undead hanging out? You'd think of the undead in a churchyard, in a graveyard kind of setting, right? Or, I don't know, down in a tomb. You know, you'd think of the necromancer maybe up in a, you know, the necromancer has a tower. Now, the vampire typically lives in a big haunted mansion. So I was trying to think, like, how connected is the vampire to the necromancer and that kind of skeleton zombie undead crew? And I mean, you could create a scenario, I suppose, where you have a big haunted mansion where the vampire lord lives. And because it's such a big and old mansion, it's like an old manor house, it's got its own churchyard with graves, okay? And I don't know, there's some old corrupted priest or something. There's a graveyard keeper, let's say, down there, who can reanimate the undead and make them come out of their graves. So, you know, in this scenario, I'm just completely making this up. But in this scenario, our hero has to come through the churchyard. He has to come through the churchyard and fight undead, like skeleton zombie hordes in the churchyard in order to get to the haunted mansion. And then once he's in the haunted mansion, I mean, let's just say the vampire lord is a bit eccentric. He has memorabilia from all around the world. You know, maybe there's an Egyptian chamber with a mummy in it, or maybe there's a... I mean, I'm just trying to spitball here. I'm just trying to think of, like, how does the vampire connect with the rest of the undead roster? And I do think that it's an open question as to how closely connected they are or are not, okay? I mean, in the Warhammer lore, the vampire lord is seen as very, very far above the rest of the undead army. So, like Manfred von Karstein, or the what are the other two called? There's the husband and wife team, Isabella, is it, and Vlad and Isabella, but they are seen as extremely far above the rest of the army, right? To the extent that they are the nobility, and even the necromancers and so on are, like, at best civil servants or something like that in the kind of undead hierarchy. So in the Warhammer world, it's dealt with like that. Is that they break out. They break off the mummies, and the mummies have their own kind of Egyptian themed faction with slightly different units. And they also have a pirate themed crew as well. What are they called? The Awakened or something. There's also the piratey flavored undead. I mean, think of LeChuck and his crew in the Monkey Island games, for example. It's a skeleton crew. You know, the skeleton pirate is another kind of set of tropes that seem to exist somewhat separately, because of course there's the, you know, the black beard, you know, the black beard and blue beard and all of that, the idea of the ghost captain and the ghost crew and the skeleton crew. So this is a separate, like, there are three separate flavors, I guess, of undead. One is all around the vampire's haunted mansion, which will be Yvonne Carstein's. One is around the Egyptian pyramid, which is your mummy crew. And then one is the idea of the pirates. I mean, I would say there are also others. There's the kind of tomb. It doesn't have to have the Egyptian theme. You can have like a gothic tomb where the skeleton warrior comes out of the tomb. There's that kind of setting as well. There's also the, if you can imagine, like in Warcraft, the necromancer or the necromancy corrupts the land. It kind of rots, kills all the trees, and it turns all of the land to blight, and all the wildlife die, and everything's dead. Thunder and lightning comes. It makes things gloomy and gray. And, you know, is connected with sorcery and magic. So I would say there's kind of few different flavors of undead there, you know, and we'll get more into that as we go on as well. All right, so that's enough preamble. How long have we been going here? We've been going an hour almost, and I haven't even got into the actual roster yet. So let's make a start. We're going to start with the skeleton, your basic tier one minion. And the skeleton, I would say, is incredibly consistent in his characteristics. He's your standard unit. He is not too strong, not too, like, he's weak typically, but not so weak that he can't hold his own in a bit of a fight. He is always definitionally average, right? I remember back in HeroQuest, he had two attack dice, two defense dice. Very, very skeleton-y, that, you know. You know, if you have a game where there are stats, the skeleton will be like dead middle of all those stats for everything. Now, there are some variations, I would say, in how the skeleton manifests. Because in some games, and I'm thinking of Warcraft 3 here, the skeleton can't actually be built. You can't actually recruit the skeleton from your city in Warcraft 3. He has to be summoned by the necromancer. And those skeleton summons in Warcraft 3 are weak as fuck. I.e., it's almost like they're looking to, they're kind of crumbling, and you sense that at any time they could turn to dust, right, in Warcraft. They're a very weak skeleton in Warcraft. In a game like Baldur's Gate, there are actually two types of skeletons, because there's the standard skeleton that comes with the Raise Undead spell, which is also of that kind of Warcraft 3 kind of weak and easily crumbled variety. But there's also the much stronger skeleton warrior that has a helmet on and a big broadsword, if you can imagine that, okay? And that's typically a much more durable unit, that stronger skeleton warrior. And in many games, there will be the two tiers. There'll be the standard weak, crumbling skeleton, and then the slightly upgraded skeleton warrior. You may also get sometimes as well the skeleton archer, friends. Is there any other types of skeletons? There's the skeleton archer, the kind of warrior upgrade that come. I mean, I seem to remember in Baldur's Gate, it's like there's a higher tier. When you level up enough, Raise Undead, instead of summoning like a couple of little skeletons, you summon one big skeleton warrior, you know. There's also I would say, the piratey skeleton, right? Hey, the little, you know, he comes with a cutlass, little pirate skeleton. But largely speaking, they're basically the same as the normal skeletons, just with a piracy theme, aren't they? Let's be honest. There's no actual difference between pirate skeleton and standard minion skeleton, I would say. Any other types of... let me just have a look at the chat here. Yeah, you can get this. Yeah, you can. They typically come with a sword, but you can get a spearman. In Warcraft, there's the skeleton spearman. Actually, a pretty good unit, actually, defensive unit. But typically, I would say this is your lot with the skeleton. You might get a lower one and a slightly tougher version. How can I put this? Yes, you can get skeleton mages. That's true. You can get the skeleton mage on occasion, which again are typically like that's a very strange thing, like a kind of mid-tier magic user, like not a high level, but a mid-tier magic user. You can get a skeleton mage. The giant skeleton, rarer, I would say, but they do exist. There are giant skeletons in Baldur's Gate, I seem to recall. Sometimes they explode when they're killed. Yeah, I would say that crumbling, like the thing is about the skeleton is that in many games there should be like a timed element where they decay and where their power is directly related to their evil kind of mind-controlling overlord, the necromancer, somewhere. That's a very standard trope. The other thing I'd say about the skeleton in most cases is that they're a mass unit. They're a mass horde unit. And that, I think when the skeleton is done best, there should be a moment where... Because, a very important part of skeletons is that they have no morale, right? They have no morale, if there's a morale mechanism in the game. But that, they have no morale, and of course they're scary, right? They induce morale. Like anybody fighting a skeleton, imagine you were fighting a skeleton, you'd be fucking scared, okay? And I think that a large element of the definitive undead roster tactics would have to be, imagine you're fighting a horde of skeletons, right? And you've just killed like six of them, seven of them, eight of them, nine of them, you're on the Legolas, Lord of the Rings run where you've killed like fucking like 350 skeletons, and my axe, they're on the Lord of the Rings run. And then they start coming back. Fuck, I just killed him and he's back. And that's the idea that after you've gone to the trouble of killing them all, they're coming back and more of them are coming. As more you kill, the more they come back. A kind of whack-a-mole mechanism. And the idea of that being a demoralization effect. It's like, oh, shit. Can you imagine? It's like disheartening. Oh, no. And the idea of that's going to grind you down. It's going to demoralize you. And then you're going to get overwhelmed. Like, in the end, you're overwhelmed. They may be individually weak, but the more of them there are, the more they keep on coming back. Fuck, we're fucked. To me, that is the absolute essence of the skeleton horde right there, what I described. Okay. So I think that there has to be, and of all the games, I think probably the best one for that feel is probably the necromancers in Warcraft 3, because in Warcraft 3, they automatically reanimate, and they also reanimate enemy troops as well. So if there's been a big blowout, a big battle, right? If you've got a lot of necromancers there, you can instantly get loads more troops. In fact, the Total War Warhammer does this quite well on the map, where it's like, oh right, we've just had a massive battle. The enemy has just given me an absolute shellacking, but it was a tough battle for them. They lost loads of men. Oh shit! They've immediately raised them all, my own men, back at me as an army. So that has to be that. Also, as people are saying, skeletons have like immunity to basically everything. They're immune to poison. They're immune to bleed. They're immune to mind spells. They're immune. They have no morale. They're immune to basically like anything to do with morale, anything to do with mind, anything to do with it, you know. So there are lots of kind of very standard things in the skeleton. Another thing I would say that is a very common feature is that they're weak to fire. If they would have to weakness, I mean, I'm just thinking like if I was playing Baldur's Gate 2 and there was a room full of skeletons, probably the first thing I'd do is I'd pause. I'd hit the space bar. I'd get Edwin, who is always in my party. I have never played Baldur's Gate without having Edwin in my party. Let me just tell you that. I'd select Edwin, and I'd just shoot a fireball at them. And the fireball, I would say 9 times out of 10, would clear out that room. I would say that the fire is always a weakness. And then in most games, there'll be like a holy, like a kind of holy warrior faction. Like in Baldur's Gate, in D&D, it'd be like your paladin, you know, your, we are the Knights of the Order type, you know, there'll be somebody like that. You know, kind of soft-coded medieval knight type faction, who would have clerics, and they'd have like, and typically they'll have like holy light or something like that. There'll be some sort of radiant spell school, you know, there'll be some kind of radiant holy power that fucking decks undead. Like, you know, I'm pretty sure that in D&D, once a cleric gets to a certain level, there's one spell that just like instantly disintegrates skeletons. Trying to remember what that's, is it unholy blight? Is it radiant light, something like that? There's one spell that instantly kills skeletons. Yeah, and you can turn, you know, of course you can turn undead as well. So yeah, turn undead. But I'm not talking about turn undead though. There's an actual spell that disintegrates, instantly blasts them. I'm trying to remember what it is now. I mean, if you're a very high level cleric, your turn undead spell will also blast them as well. Okay. Yeah, that's right. I mean, yeah, turn undead basically disintegrates them straight away. All right, that's probably enough on the skeletons, unless anybody has any comments or questions. Any skeleton questions? No, okay. All right, let's carry on then. So next we have the zombie. And I would say that, as we saw, the zombie is ever-present in the undead roster. It's in every single game I looked at. one interesting thing is the extent to which there's crossover between the zombie that we see in the fantasy undead roster and the zombie that we see in kind of mainstream horror stuff. Because I feel like the crossover between those two things is quite minimal. Because there's been a lot of zombie. There was a period where there were lots of zombie movies. About 5 years ago, there was tons of zombie stuff. And there was that kind of point-and-click zombie game that was big. But I feel like those zombies don't have much to do with these zombies here. These zombies here have incredibly consistent characteristics, okay? Here are the basic characteristics of this zombie. Tough, but slow. No attack, higher defense. That's all zombies everywhere. The zombie is tougher than the skeleton. Okay? The zombie is slower than the skeleton. And this was already there back in HeroQuest. Because the skeleton could move 6 squares. The zombie could only move 4. The skeleton had 2 defense dice. The zombie had 3. Very standard. And the core use of the zombie is that, I mean, I know that, you know, some modern things are like, oh, I know a game where the zombies can run. I know a game where the zombies can, you know, are frenzied. I know a game, you know, I don't care about any of that. I'm talking about classic fantasy here. And in the classic fantasy trope, the zombie is tough but slow. Tough but slow, with slightly higher defense than the skeleton, but low attack. That is the zombie in all games. I will accept no counters. No counters whatsoever. And the skeleton, I would say, very possibly might have a slightly higher upkeep cost than the skeleton, if there is one, but ever so slightly higher. And in almost all cases will be available at the start of the game or tier one unlock, right? The zombie should be slow. The zombie should be lolloping. You know a zombie. And, I mean, I remember in Heroes of Might and Magic, the zombie was so slow that if you wanted to take the zombie from the left side of the battle to the right side of the battle, it'd take about 10 minutes. Because they only move like two squares in that game. They were ridiculously slow in Heroes of Might and Magic, a very slow unit. And their purpose is almost always the same, right? The purpose of the zombie is always the same, which is essentially to act as a kind of time sink, meat shield, delay, bog down. You know, they're going to bog you down, and they're going to be like, you know, and they could be fielded with the skeletons, or in some cases not. In some cases, it could be just zombies. In most cases, I would say the zombies and the skeletons are mixed. And again, I'm not actually sure what the mechanism is as to whether somebody turns into a zombie or turns into a skeleton. Maybe it's just stages of decay or whatever. But for whatever reason, in undead lore, having more flesh on you means you're slower and tougher. having less flesh on you and being a skeleton means you're slightly faster and slightly better at attacking. That's always the case. Yeah, exactly. Zombies are mud. Zombies are basically mud as a game mechanism, right? No, Telos, the heart covering the chat is extremely annoying. I don't know what to do about that. All right, so any zombie questions? I would say that there are some good points being made in chat. When the necromancer loses control of zombies and skeletons, they tend to collapse, but sometimes roam about, killing all in sight like zombies in horror. It's true that the skeleton crumbles and can kind of, because you can imagine the bones are only being kept together through reanimation. So there's a kind of there's a fragility to the skeleton, whereas the zombie, yes, you're right. There is this idea that the zombie can be lost control of because it's an actual corpse that is being animated. Very interesting point. You could possibly, yes, I agree with that. I agree with that comment. I would also say that in some games, there is the fat zombie, right? This is the abomination in Warcraft 3, for example, has got one of these units, the abomination. And the fat zombie is almost always kind of like a... You can imagine his characteristics. He's even tougher. He'll have a better attack. For some reason, I imagine him as a chef a lot, like a dead butcher or a dead chef. I feel like Dark Souls has got a few of them around. Brent Taylor says, "What the hell are we talking about?" Well, Brent, I don't know what your IQ is, mate, but we're talking about the undead. We're talking about the definitive undead roster in an imagined fantasy game after taking an aggregate of all the undead rosters in lots of the fantasy games I could think of. If that doesn't sound like your cup of tea, mate, get out of here. Go on your bike, son. Okay, so Yes. Anything else about zombies? I think that that's pretty much it. There is the fat zombie variant. I tell you what, there is another. There is a slightly different variant of the zombie that you can get as well, which is that you can get like a kind of diseased zombie, like a zombie that carries like a disease aura, or is you know, some other way enhanced by disease or pestilence or something like that. They could have like flies buzzing around them, or you know, they could have like that smelly, you know, like when they try to do smell, like a kind of smelly aura around them. That I would say is also a very common trope. The souped up, the slightly souped up disease zombie. And I mean, I'd have to check, but I'm fairly sure in some of those games, like the Might and Magic and Warlords or whatever, the upgrade on the zombie is like diseased zombie or something like that. Maybe occasionally the frenzied zombie, which will have a couple of extra movement points or something. But again, they're not going to be able to like run. They may just move more. You know, if the zombie has movement 4, the frenzy zombie would have movement like 6 or something, right? As against the movement of like 8 for an orc or 10 for a goblin, if that makes any sense. So they're still slow, but they're just faster than the normal zombie, okay? Werewolves are not part of the undead roster, Doubt. Werewolves are not part of the undead roster, I'm afraid. They are part of a separate... I mean, I don't actually know if they exist as part of a standard army roster, the werewolf, but they're not undead. And they're not part of the... There's no... I mean, the one unit that I left off that could have been included is the bat. The bat is very often included as part of the kind of the vampire thing, because vampires... The vampire mansion will have bats around, right? Sometimes it's called something like a fell bat, or sometimes the bat itself will be undead or whatever. And I left that out. The bat has not made the undead roster because I felt that... I mean, some games have the mechanism where the vampire can turn into the bat. I think in Heroes of Might and Magic, when the vampire flies, he turns into a bat. But I just, I don't know. I feel like the bat shouldn't be part of the undead roster, personally. But anyway, let's carry on. Yeah, it doesn't matter if you've just arrived. You've got eyes. You can read. You've got a brain. The stream is called the Definitive Undead Roster. I've got a screen with a zombie on it, and I'm talking about a zombie. What the fuck do you think we're talking about, you bloody moron? Come on now. No excuses. You've been around long enough. I can see you're a channel member. Doesn't matter. Use your loaf. Don't ask stupid questions. Ask stupid questions. Win stupid prizes. All right, let's carry on. So, here is a ghoul. Here is a ghoul. Okay, now a lot of people ask, what is a ghoul? And a ghoul has a number of characteristics, I would say. A ghoul is almost always... a ghoul is almost always a kind of frenzy, fast, kind of almost... they have a kind of frenetic energy about them. The ghoul, and they're a bit more savage, and they're a bit more wild than your typical skeleton or zombie, and they're hungry. You know, they are flesh eating, and they'll bite your face off. You know, and they hang around tombs and things like that. I'm not actually sure about what the status of the ghoul is vis-a-vis being undead. i.e. are they simply corrupted, or have they been reanimated? That is a good question. And I'm now wondering if the wondering about that. Let me pull up ghouls on the D&D wiki a minute. Which will actually have the Forgotten Realms wiki, which will basically crib all its information from either the Monster Manual or the that book I mentioned earlier on. Let's have a look. A ghoul appeared as an emaciated, roughly humanoid creature with an almost hairless, mottled, decaying hide stretched tight over its bones. It had sharp teeth of a carnivore and sunken eyes that burned as if they were hot coals. That's from Monster Manual 3.5 from 2003. Ghouls could paralyze their victims with a claw or a bite wound, though elves were immune. Paralysis lasted at least a dozen seconds and up to half a minute. Like most types of undead, ghouls were immune to mind-affecting spells such as sleep. The bite of a ghoul also inflicted terrible disease, ghoul fever, deteriorating health and agility within a day. Any who died from the illness rose as a ghoul at midnight. So there you go. You could actually become a ghoul by being bitten by a ghoul. So it seems like they're part of like vampire canon in some strange way. I feel like ghouls would live in the vampire's grounds, you know, in the churchyard of the vampire's haunted mansion or whatever. Let's have a look. How did they become? Ghouls hunted alone in gangs of up to four, or packs of seven or to 12 members, apparently. It was believed that a living man or woman who tasted the flesh of people would rise again as ghouls after they died. This was not proven, but it fitted their cannibalistic behavior. However, oaths believed that anyone who indulged in extreme debauchery and evil could become a ghoul after death. Shit, there's going to be a lot of ghouls in a few years, isn't there? Whatever the truth, it was clear that any humanoid who was bitten by a ghoul, contracted ghoul fever and died of it, would inevitably rise as a ghoul themselves the following night at midnight, unless they were blessed or blessed and resurrected by a cleric before they could turn. A newly risen ghoul lost all the skills and powers that it had in life. Their minds became warped, turning them feral, yet cunning and hungry for living flesh, becoming in all other ways like a ghoul. They were not bound to serve other ghouls, however. So, yeah, pretty disgusting creature, really. They become... And you can see their route into being undead is not the same as the skeleton or the zombie. The ghoul is not part of the necromancer's reanimated army. The ghoul... Like, the necromancer cannot create a ghoul. A ghoul has to be made through being bitten by another ghoul, or apparently through being so debauched in life that you become a ghoul. So, yes. And they're very much cannibalistic, as you can see, right? Ghouls are coomers, yeah. So that explains a lot of the ghoul lore. And you'll notice, by the way, that ghouls are not present in lots of games. But I would say that they're present enough that, and their characteristics are kind of standard and recognizable enough for them to be part of the definitive roster. Also, in terms of game design, the undead need fast units from somewhere. They need some unit that can be fast. And the ghoul is your, you know, they're feral. They're kind of frenzied. And they're quick. Unlike the slow-moving zombie or skeleton horde, right? The vibe of the zombie or skeleton horde is like, whereas the vibe of the ghoul is like, and this is a different. You need that dynamism in the undead army, right? So, ghouls are undead. They're always undead, but ghouls come from a separate, their path into being undead is different, as I just outlined. Okay. Let's carry on then. Let's carry on. So another undead unit is the ghost. Now, I was in two minds about including the ghost in the definitive roster. As I said, lots of times the ghost is actually a kind of non-hostile NPC type character who you have to do a quest for in order to release their soul or whatever. But I would say the ghost is present enough to be included. In one case, in Heroes of Might and Magic, the ghost was actually so annoying as to be game-breaking. The ghost in Heroes of Might and Magic was terrible because they basically couldn't be killed, and they multiplied every time they killed somebody, they gained numbers. Oh, they were a pain in the ass. And they had to be recruited from like a separate, you know, like where you recruited the genies and things in that game. They couldn't be recruited from a standard place. They had to be recruited from a special place. And I'm not only just reciting the monster manual. I'm not only doing that. I've done other things on this stream, but you know, for the ghoul, I thought monster manual was a good thing to the ghost, I would say, is present enough in most games to warrant inclusion. I would say of all the different creatures, the ghost is the one with the least defined set of traits. Being somewhat translucent, I think, is probably part of it. You can get more like a kind of spirit ghost, if you can imagine, like sometimes they're very kind of wavy, the kind of spirit ghost thing. Sometimes you can get the more, you know, the more kind of classic, you know, the white sheet type ghost. Although I can't think of any examples right now. But I feel like the ghost would, what would their characteristics be typically? They could be floating. I think they'd be floating most of the time. It'd be a floating unit, which didn't touch the floor. They'd fly. Librarian ghost, yeah. I mean, there are tons of librarian ghosts in Baldur's Gate that I seem to remember. They can move through terrain easily. One of the things of a ghost was to be that they'd have no debuffs on terrain. Possibly they could move through walls. They could do possession. Absolutely. Absolutely. The ghost, if anybody was to be dropped from this roster, the ghost would be the first on the chopping block, I think. And, you know, it was between these and bats, really, right? And I thought the ghost is a bit more in keeping with the undead theme. Nathan is right. The ghosts cause fear. The ghosts cause fear, yeah. And then the last of the rank and file, the rank and file crew, is the Wraith. And the Wraith is a higher tier unit. It's kind of on the cusp of being elite, but typically they'll be fast moving. Typically they'll be they'll have a lot of the characteristics of those ghosts that we just mentioned, because they could float as well, and induce a lot of fear and so on. But the idea of the Wraith usually is that they'll be fast moving and quite powerful. They're present pretty often, I would say, the Wraith. And they usually have the kind of the Grim Reaper vibe, the kind of Grim Reaper. They'll have a scythe and so on. You'll be surprised how many games have the Wraith, right? You'll be surprised how many people have the Wraith. I haven't got to Liches yet. The Wraith has got lots of things where they're, because they often have a lot of immunities to physical attacks, the Wraith. Hard to kill. Maybe you need some sort of special magic to take them down, or, you know, magic weapons, or there'll be something. Like, I imagine in some D&D adventures, the Wraith would just be like immune to normal weapons, something like that. I don't know. So the Wraith is basically, if you want to say, like a kind of an upgrade on the Ghost, but it's kind of like a, it's not a direct upgrade because the Ghost is often bound up with this idea of purgatory, and whereas the Wraith comes more as a kind of avenging angel or figure of death or something like this. I'm actually interested to know what the Monster Manual says about the Wraith. So I'll have a look. You see, Wraiths in D&D are much more floaty. I'll just show you the Wraith in D&D. Looks a bit more like this. Like a dead king or something like that. But basically you get what, you know, it's like, you know, they're not dissimilar to the Nazgul, I suppose, in Lord of the Rings, I suppose. But let's have a look at what it says. It says, Wraiths were powerless in natural sunlight, appearing as sinister spectral figures robed in darkness. They had no visual features or appendages except for their glowing red eyes. Okay. They could drain life from living creatures, turning them into new Wraiths. Wraiths became far weaker when they're exposed to full sunlight. Like many undead, Wraiths possessed a chilling touch. Okay. Right. I'm just reading. I mean, yeah, I think the idea is that the Wraith is often a remnant of a dead king or something like that. Very often that the, you know, this was a person of note in some sort of way. And also that they are tied to darkness more readily. They'll have some sort of absolute weakness, like, you know, can't be seen in the sunlight, or, you know, they're tied to like primordial darkness in some strange way. They're tied to death. So there are kind of limitations on where a Wraith can be, if that makes any sense. You won't see a Wraith, you know, walking up the high streets or something like that. All right, let's carry on in the interest of time. So now we're moving on to the elite units, and we have the Banshee. And the Banshee has some incredibly set characteristics. And I believe these are taken from Irish mythological lore, but again, as they're codified in fantasy games, they're very, very standard. So the Banshee is almost always female, or is basically a female unit. The Banshee is always an elite unit of some kind, which means that you won't see them hoarded, right? At most, you'll encounter like two or three Banshees, or like one Banshee hanging around lower tier units or something like that. But typically, you'll see like two or three of them at most in one place. And they will have various special powers. Sometimes they can float. Sometimes they're on foot, but I think most of the time they float. They kind of always look like this image here. You know, this basic image of the Banshee. And of course, their typical powers involve a kind of piercing scream a lot of the time. Piercing scream. In some cases, they have seduction powers as well, where they can kind of give you a kiss or whatever. You know, kind of like a kind of corrupted nymph, if that makes any sense. But most of the time, it's the piercing scream that they can do. They may also have things like chilling touch or frog. I don't get what's going on. Right, you're banned. You're banned. Anyone else going to fucking mess around? I don't get what's going on. Are you fucking moron? Banned. I'm not having it. The stream is called The Definitive Undead Roster. I'm talking about zombies and banshees. If you're joking, don't bloody joke. I'm not in the mood. Okay. So, yeah, like a succubus, exactly, like a succubus. And often you get the mythologies of the succubus and the nymph and the banshee are kind of played with a little bit in various different forms. But you know, if I see one more person say, I don't understand what we're doing, or I don't know what we're talking about, or, you know, what are we doing? Just don't say it. Go for a walk. Have a cup of tea. Go for a cigarette. Don't irritate and distract me during my stream. I'm not having it. Okay. So, yes, I don't know if the banshee is a... I don't know about how banshees come about. Let's have a look at the Forgotten Realms on the banshee. How do they come about? Groaning spirit or wailing ghost, a female undead phantom, typically a selfish and strong-willed spirit that embodied the essence of hideousness. Oftentimes they were the spirits of elven women whom in life had an evil alignment. Yeah, so there's some weird crossover there. Maybe it's a sometimes it's a nymph. What else can banshees do typically? They enjoy bringing death to any living creature that they come across. They don't have a defined shape. They have a misty form with a vague flowing features, mirrored her former form in life. As time wore on, a banshee became more and more distorted, though was still recognized as a humanoid. Abilities. Although their shape was incorporeal, the appearance of a banshee was horrific, and their mere presence would draw the energy from their surroundings to the point of stunting local floral growth. So they kill flowers due to their horrific appearance. Being a form of undead, banshees were immune to all manner of spells that affected the mind, such as charm and sleep, typically impervious to harm from lightning and excessive cold. How did they come about, though? Doesn't say how they come about. Just that they're typically elven women or evil elven women of some sort. Okay. Typically found around desolate countrysides and moors. That's true. I'd imagine a banshee with like a kind of moon, a shadow moon in the background, you know. So, all right, yeah. Pretty standard. Like you saw at the start, the banshee is not always present in the undead roster, but I feel like they're included about half of the time, and I thought they should be on the definitive roster. Bit of diversity for the team, you know, So, then we have the mummy. Again, once upon a time, very standard. And then for a period, at least, less standard. Now, the mummy, back in when I was playing HeroQuest and so on, did not necessarily come with Egyptian themes. I think these days people think mummy, they think Egyptian theme. But once upon a time, I distinctly recall the mummy being somewhat removed from its kind of Egyptian roots, and they were much more of a kind of just, you know, they were just kind of wandering around down the corridor or whatever. There are some pretty standard tropes, I would say, for the mummy. The mummy is much tougher than the skeleton or the zombie, right? Remember I was saying about the hit dice? I'm pretty sure the mummy was a attack 3, defend 4 creature in HeroQuest. You know, attack 3 attack dice, 4 defend dice. They're a level, they're a tier 3 troop. They're a mid, kind of mid or upper mid elite kind of unit. And very often, I would say, the mummy would have a kind of curse ability where they, which would be some sort of debuff or passive debuff on the enemy, you know, curse touch or something. There'd be some curse element, which meant their attacks were better than standard attacks, you know, so they'd have a pretty high attack, pretty high defense, and they'd never be massed either. You know, you may have like one or two in a room, two or maybe even three in a room, but they'd never be a mass horde unit, right? They'd only be, you know, one or two, because they're tough, you know, and they should represent a threat to, you know, a mid-level party in an RPG should probably have a few reloads on a mummy, I'd imagine, most of the time. They'd be quite a tough unit, you know, causing problems. They may, you know, their curse abilities may force arrest or something in an RPG. So, yeah. Anything else about the mummy? I would say that, yeah, very vulnerable to fire, of course. Very vulnerable to fire. Triple A, by the way, has got this standing joke whenever Triple A sees a mummy. She says, "Oh, it's loo paper, Dad. It's loo paper. It's loo paper." I was like, "No, it's bandages." "No, it's loose paper. I saw it, Steve and Maggie." Yeah. So, yeah. Now, I would say another element of another element, right? Honestly, if I see more people bugging me in chat, it's just going to be like a zero. This channel is going to become a zero low IQ tolerance zone. No tolerance for low IQ, right? Do not ask stupid questions. Paralysis touch is another really common feature where, you know, it's going to freeze you dead sometimes. The werewolf is not part of the undead roster, Jolly Man. The werewolves are not part of the undead roster. I already talked about that. Okay. So what else have we got? I would say that mummies can, in some circumstances, level up into, like in some games, in some settings, the mummy can become a lord character, right? And this is where they, if they lean into the pyramid thing and the Egyptian theme, there's a variant of the mummy who's like a mummy lord, mummy king, you know, the Ramesses or the, you know, the second coming of, you know, some Egyptian, like there's definitely a version. Yeah. The tomb king. Exactly. And I'd say this is an extremely common trope, to the point where in Warcraft, the Total Hammer Warcraft, they're a separate faction. There's the Tomb King separate faction where their lord units are indeed very powerful mummies. And I would say those more powerful mummies then have the potential to become boss units. You know, it's a boss fight. They've got significant magics of some description or other, you know. I'm not actually that clear on what the souped up lord mummy powers would be. They'd be hard. They'd have high attack and high defense, but what are the kind of typical Tomb King type abilities would there be? See, there's a kind of weird thing where even though the mummy is always vulnerable to fire, I imagine the Tomb Kings would have some sort of sun-inspired spells, because that's typically Egyptian stuff has got sun involvement. Summoning and resurrection, yeah. Necromancy, yeah. Mummy lore would have minions. Powerful artifacts, yeah. They might wear like a magical crown or magical armor of some description. Stronger quirk, stronger curse. Absolutely. Scarabs, yeah. I mean, there's a slightly different theming to the mummy, the very mummified Egyptian undead. Yes. Okay. All right, so let's carry on then. That's the mummy. I actually really like the mummy. I've always had a kind of special affection for the mummy and the kind of vibe around the mummy, you know. So let's carry on. Then we have the white. And as we saw at the start, the white, again, is surprisingly almost ever present. Even though I would say that the white, in terms of mainstream, non-nerd, non-fantasy penetration, so normieville, in other words, has zero penetration whatsoever. I would say the white is known among nerds and people who are into fantasy games and D&D and so on, but the white is not known to anyone who's not interested in this stuff, right? Would you agree with that? The white is zero popular culture penetration. You would never see a white appear in AAA's Halloween book, for example. It's not part of like horror canon. It's not part of mainstream monster canon. It is only part of fantasy nerd canon, if that makes any sense. And the white, again, is always an elite unit. He's always this kind of much more powerful than the skeleton or the zombie. He will wear special armor. He will be more agile. And for all intents and purposes, he's like an all-purpose, good all-round warrior unit, usually. In the Total War Warhammer games, he's a hero unit as opposed to a lord, which is basically as high as the highest elite tier unit you can do. I'm trying to think of other examples of whites in games. A more strong skeleton. Yeah, I mean, for some reason, I get the impression that the white is less mindless than the typical zombie or skeleton minion. Let me just look up the Forgotten Realms on the white. Some of the lore on the white, because I've never been quite clear as to who exactly they're meant to be. So this is what the undead, the wiki says. This is from Monster Manual 3.5 again. A white was an undead creature given a semblance of life through sheer violence and hatred. They could drain the life energy out of victims by touch, turning them into new whites upon death. So a white can actually create new undead themselves, apparently, in D&D. Whites appeared as a weird and twisted reflections of the forms they had in life. They existed in a state between being alive and being dead. When attacking their prey, white's eyes glowed like white hot embers. Their mummified flesh covered the twisted skeleton, and the hands ended up in deadly claws. The teeth were sharp and jagged like needles. Most whites were humanoid. You see, I definitely get the impression that the white is kind of more together, has more of their former life in them than the mere skeleton or zombie. I don't think they're a mindless minion. They're an intelligent, you know, they have intelligence of some sort. Whites were evil, undead creatures brought back to unlife by their vanity, evil deeds, and desires. Upon the ends of their mortal lives, the dying spirits reached out to Orcus, or another evil deity, receiving undeath in exchange for spending eternity hating and trying to destroy all living beings. Whites retain their personalities and memories in the undeath. They possessed free will at the same time as they were tasked to perform the bidding of the evil powers that brought them back. So, you see, they are conscious. They have their wits about them. They're intelligent. You see? Even though whites hungered for living beings' energy, they did not require it as a source of sustenance. The whites could retain the undeath trapped in tombs for centuries. Their craving for life energy was more akin to an addiction. Sages theorized that when a white drained a victim's life energy, it received a rush of mortality, a euphoric reminder of their mortal existence. Chasing that feeling led to extremely depraved actions by whites. So they're much more like kind of weird semi-living drug addicts, apparently. Whites were territorial creatures. They rarely traveled away from their burial places or locations they knew in life unless commanded by their masters. Some exceptions to the rules indeed existed. Scholars theorize that the whites' attachment to their tombs was due to its reminder of their condition, a source of pride rather than sorrow. Another theory was that they dwelled in catacombs simply due to the tactical benefits of winding corridors and shadows. On the contrary to wide belief, whites could be born anywhere, not necessarily only in crypts and burial mounds. There were rumors of aquatic whites returning to unlife among shipwrecks, possibly relating whites to Lacedons, which is a kind of aquatic ghoul, apparently. So, yeah, I think we basically get now the basic function of the white. He's a more intelligent unit. He's more with it. He's more humanoid. Always a good warrior. You know, there'll be a tough... Like the mummy, they'll be tough in an RPG setting. If I was playing an RPG, I reckon an encounter with a white would probably trigger a quick save. Save before the room, just in case he kills you. I think a white should be powerful enough to trigger a quick save in an RPG setting. Whites have a pirate variant as well. I don't know if whites have a pyramid variant, but why not? Why not? That's your basic white. Then we have the bone dragon. I mean, we talked about these earlier, but the bone dragon is ever present. It's always there on the undead roster. It is always the tier 5 unlock. It is always the most expensive unit. It is always the top of the tech tree, and you'll never be able to get that many of them because they're so expensive. The upkeep will be expensive. Okay. So, that's the bone dragon, basically. And, they will have all the characteristics of the regular dragon, only they'll be dead. And I feel like the bone dragon would always have some sort of icy or shadowy or kind of ice breath, some kind of cold. I feel like the bone dragon comes with associations of cold 9 times out of 10. I don't know if there's a difference between the bone dragon and the zombie dragon. I feel like basically they're all variants on the same basic idea that, you know, this is a reanimated dragon, essentially, which is as fearsome. It's just like, it's a power unit, a massively powerful unit for the undead. And I don't know what else to say about it, really. I mean, there are some variants. You can have like the shadow dragon, like the black, you can imagine like a black shadow dragon where it's not undead, but it's has icy breath or whatever. But I would say 9 times out of 10, it's the bone dragon on the undead roster. And certainly for my definitive undead roster, the elite power level 5 unlock is going to be your Bone Dragon. Should be a late tier encounter in any RPG, like a late game encounter in any game, strategy or RPG or whatever else. I mean, if a white is causing a quick save, I think the Bone Dragon is causing a separately named save game, yeah. Just in case one. I don't know what your save game conventions are when you're playing computer games, but I tend to have like a rolling file, like, you know, say it's Morcar 1, Morcar 2, Morcar 3. But sometimes I do emergency save, name it, you know, just because sometimes you can get yourself in a situation where you're absolutely stuck, right? And you want to have a save at a point where you're not stuck in the fight with the bloody dragon, you know? I would say that the Bone Dragon should be that scary in the RPG setting, and in the strategy game setting, it's a late tier unit which can single-handedly take out whole units of infantry, for example. You know, in Total War, one of those Bone Dragons can take on a single 120 infantry unit on its own, kill them all. It's a dragon, basically. So, the Bone Dragon will cause a cutscene most of the time. But it's not a Lord unit. It's a very high elite tier unit, because dragons, normal dragons, can also be lords. They can also be like, end boss or whatever. Bone Dragon doesn't have a personality. Bone Dragon is actually serving a master most of the time. It's mindless. It has other characteristics of undead, right? So it's not quite, there's no intelligence there for the Bone Dragon. It doesn't talk. It's a minion. It's just a very, very high tier minion, right? Of course, we have the Necromancer, absolutely standard, central to the undead roster, I would say. And the Necromancer, usually, his key role is raising undead, of course. I mean, the Necromancer should be raising lots and lots and lots of skeletons or zombies. That's his main role. I would say that, you see, I've put him as a high elite unit rather than a lord. And let me tell you why, right? Because the Necromancer has got into this. Like, the Necromancer has found his way into the undead roster in the first place through, like, study and pursuit of knowledge and things like that. But almost always in the kind of Faustian story, because the Necromancer is a version of Faust, right? He's a version of the Faust myth. And almost always in that kind of Faustian pact, there is the decision to serve some sort of higher power of darkness, right? So for that reason, the Necromancer is almost always effectively the middle manager in the undead army, right? The Necromancer answers to the lords, and he controls most of the minions, the undead, okay? He's a middle manager unit. The Necromancer is seldom, if ever, the end boss, the ultimate lord, the ultimate controller of the undead army. Does anybody disagree with this? Can anybody think of, like, lord level, boss level Necromancers? I feel like the Necromancer is always a number two or a middle manager or a kind of sub boss. Anybody disagree? Yeah, the undead manager, Yuri Revolution, exactly. manager from Swindon Branch. Because the Necromancer's basically sold his soul. He sold himself or he's exchanged for this massive power that he's gained, he usually has to serve somebody else, whether it's a dark god or dark deity or some, like, you know, in the Warhammer setting, and one of the von Karsteins or whatever else it is, you know. The necro is a middle manager always, but the necromancer is also often extremely powerful, you know. As well as his raise undead abilities, he will usually have spells, damage spells that he can cast, death spells, you know, direct damage spells, debuff spells, you know, buff spells to the undead. Like, he usually has a pretty good spell book, the necromancer. The only lord necromancer I can think of is in Heroes of Might and Magic 3. His name is, he's got a skull for a face. Sandro the necromancer. In the Might and Magic series, Sandro is a kind of necromancer for hire. He's still basically a middle manager in the lore, but Sandro is the highest tier or the highest level necromancer I can think of in any game, basically. Usually they're a sub boss. What else? I think that's about it for the necromancer. I mean, the only other question of the necromancer, which I think we've already answered really, is whether the necromancer is alive, still a human, or is actually undead and like a skeleton or whatever. And I think we answer that question. They have entered into this kind of weird zone, a bit like the white, where they're neither quite alive nor quite dead. But they're not resurrected. They're corrupted through power. That's basically what the... And that could come with rotting flesh. I mean, think of like Palpatine in Star Wars, where his flesh is all like corrupted and, you know, he's scarred with the evil or whatever. The necromancer has a bit of that, usually, I would say, depending on the lore in the game. But he is not the most powerful unit in the army. He is a powerful unit, an important middle manager, but not lord level. And now we're going to get on to the lords. So, first of the three lord units is the Death Knight. Now, there's some variation here, because there's one variant of the Death Knight that comes as the top of the elite unit, right? I'm imagining you're playing an RPG and there's a room, like a sub-boss room, on the way to the ultimate boss, where there's, I don't know, four Death Knights, nameless Death Knights, and they're fucking hard and it's a tough battle. You don't know anything about them, but they're sub-bosses, right? You've all played that battle. Every single person here has played that battle that I'm describing. I don't know which game. There's definitely one in Baldur's Gate somewhere. Pretty sure there's one in Dark Souls somewhere as well. But you've played that game, you've played that battle against, like, oh, there are four Death Knights. They're hard as fuck. Now you've got a battle. I mean, that's another, you know, that's another kind of separate save job before that battle, whatever it is, right? But there is another variant of the Death Knight where the Death Knight is named. The archetypical example is Arthas in the Warcraft games, Warcraft 3, in the Frozen Throne. Arthas is basically the lead character. The Death Knight, in almost every one of those Heroes of Might and Magic style games, the turn-based strategy games, is almost always a lord unit. And basically the purpose of the Death Knight is as a melee lord or hero unit, as against the magic user lord types, which we're going to get onto. You know, he's a knight. He has a fucking big sword. he's probably some sort of, you know, dead king or dead noble of some variety. He wears huge armor. He is hard as nails, immune to many, many different types of attacks and magics, I'd imagine. Huge damage, huge defense, possibly some magic in there as well. Not a huge magic user, but he's like a, you know, he's your top level melee, I would say, 9 times out of 10. The sword, that's a very good point there from the guy in the chat. The sword can come as Soul Calibur. You know, do you remember the big sword in Soul Calibur? Do you remember, there's actually a Death Knight in Soul Calibur. What was the character's name? Siegfried, I want to say, in the Soul Calibur games, which is a fighting game, becomes Nightmare, doesn't he? He becomes Nightmare when he wields the Soul Blade. The sword itself, that's a very good point. In fact, I would say that the Death Knight will almost always have special equipment in some sense. His sword will be corrupting and magic in some way. His arm, you know, he may have magic armor. Absolutely, yeah. He's a paladin. Exactly. He's a dark paladin. That's right. He took the sword from Cervantes. Cervantes had the dual blades. So this guy here is saying, how can the Death Knight be ranked below the Necromancer? This is absurd take. I explained at the start of the stream that there's some give and take here, right? Whereby the Necromancer can sometimes be a lord, but is often a kind of high elite tier unit, middle manager, as I just explained. And the Death Knight is very often just a very high elite tier unit or a sub-boss, as I just explained. So there's some give and take here. But if you look across in the aggregate, across many, many, many different franchises, the Death Knight is very often a lord unit, very often. And in fact, within the same game or within the same franchise, you can get both varieties. You can get the sub-boss Death Knight and the Arthur style, or the Siegfried Nightmare style of Death Knight. And the very important point is that the Death Knight is named, and that is what typically marks out him as a lord unit or a hero unit. Okay. Whereas the Necromancer is very often part of the actual army itself, very often part of the army itself, and not the lord. And in fact, I just asked everybody to can you name named Necromancer lords? Apart from Sandro from Heroes of Mighty Magic, I can't think of anyone. Who's an actual named Necromancer lord? He's always a sub. He's always a middle manager, the Necromancer, always. So I've thought about this. I've thought about it. You'd think that the Death Knight would be below the Necromancer, but actually he's not. The Death Knight is very often a lord, very often. And it makes sense because the Death Knight gets to wield specialist equipment, specialist swords, specialist armor, etc. So he's actually quite a good player character type person to control. It makes sense to make the Death Knight a lord unit for that sense. Hormungorst, isn't he a necromancer? I suppose he's a necromancer, but Hormungorst is shit, isn't he? So Heinrich Kemmler. The thing is, Hormungorst, at least in the one I played, is a number two to Manfred von Karstein. I know in the new one they've kind of given him his own faction now, haven't they? But it's very rare. It's very rare, is what I'm saying. And this is not like particular laws. This is aggregate law, the definitive undead roster. And I would say on balance, typically, the Necromancer is a middle manager. Oh, yeah. All right. Camilla's a Lich Lord, apparently. So there we go. Yeah. Helm and Gorse and Sandro are the only two Lord Necromancers I can think of off the top of my head. Whereas Death Knights, there are many others. There are many of them. So let us carry on. Because the next Lord up is the Lich. And I think that this is why the Necromancer is not higher up, actually. Is not a Lord, but a high elite tier unit. Because the Lich eats the Necromancer's breakfast, if you want to put it that way. Everything the Necromancer... I mean, the Lich is just a kind of next-level spellcaster unit, okay? If, I mean, the Lich is powerful enough that if you meet one in Baldur's Gate, you not only do you have to do the kind of named safety save game, possibly even two of them, because you can get into situations where you're absolutely fucked against a Lich. You know, if you're low level and you face the Lich in Baldur's Gate, they'll cast a time cast spell trigger, unleash the entire spell book and fucking kill you in 2 seconds. The Lich is a powerful, powerful magic user. Now I'm not actually sure what the lore of the Lich is, other than I know that a Lich is often ancient, old. They've been there for a long time. They've accumulated knowledge over hundreds, if not thousands of years. Somebody in the chat is saying a Lich is a successful necromancer. Maybe that's true. Maybe if you stay in necromancy and you stay as a necromancer long enough, you graduate to being a Lich eventually, right? But I don't associate the Lich with raising undead. I always associate the Necromancer with raising the Horde. I associate the Lich with not so much with raising the Horde, but with fucking decking you with high tier spells. The Lich should be able to wipe out whole armies almost single-handedly. He's that powerful. Extremely powerful magic using unit, I would say. Wherein, you know, like in a D&D encounter, if you've got a party of six, the Lich could take the party on his own, if that makes any sense, right? Now he will have summons as part of his spell book, but I'm saying that the summons for the Necromancer is the bread and butter, whereas I think for the Lich it's kind of okay. There's a few skeletons to fight, but I'm still gonna just, you know, he can cast anything on you. So, yeah. I mean, a Lich is basically almost like a kind of a dragon level encounter, if that makes any sense. But also pivotally, if you're playing as the undead, if you have the undead roster, the Lich is so powerful that he is the player character. You will play as the Lich commanding the army or whatever. He will be the Lord. Does anybody disagree with this? Does anybody think that I have this wrong? Let me just see what the lore is on the Lich in the old monster manual here. A Lich, sometimes called Lichni, was an almost universally evil form of undead spellcaster of great power. Usually a wizard, but possibly also a sorcerer, a warlock, or a cleric. Liches were feared by mortal beings for their malign magic, their intelligence, and their willingness to embrace undeath for a chance to live forever, or rather, to endure forever. Lichdom was arguably the most powerful form of undeath. Okay, I'll just go down. Liches were generally gaunt and skeletal, with withered flesh, stretched tight across horribly visible bones. They could vary greatly in appearance depending on their age and level of decay. If their eyes had been destroyed or lost or rotted away, bright pinpoints of crimson light burned in their empty sockets. Some maintained a hint of their old hair or beards. Liches often did not have lips or the necessary organs to produce natural speech, but they had the ability to project speech from their mouths magically, moving the jaw, if present, to aid the illusion. As their bodies continued to degrade over the centuries, a lich might eventually become a demi-lich. Oh, to talk about battles, if you fight the demi-lich at Baldur's Gate, you're fucked. In fact, you have to have the mirror shield, otherwise you will die. And I've never beaten that demi-lich legally. I've beaten it through the mirror shield or whatever, or through, you know, you put a special anti-mace spell on Corgan and hope for the best or whatever. But there is no way of beating that demi-lich through legal tactics. You have to cheese it. It's just too powerful. It's just like a skull, I seem to recall. But anyway, let's continue. Some liches dressed in regal and finery, fine and rich regal finery and jewelry. Others wore the clothes or uniforms of their former occupations or allegiances, while many appeared to be nothing more than lepers, as their clothes had rotted away. When moving, they seemed to glide as if floating in water. And here's some artwork of the lich. I'll just, like, they are intelligent because they could read. Look, there's one bored looking. He's been studying for centuries. There's many, you know, here are the different. Here's a monster manual. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay. And I would say it's pretty much set in stone that the lich is top of the tree, top of the line, ultimate lord of the undead. They are spellcasters who sought immortality through lichdom. They tended not to do so merely for fear of death, but to buy themselves limitless time to pursue their own ambitious goals. They discarded any mortal connections in favor of a solitary existence, generally to pursue magical power and knowledge. I mean, I would agree with the basic idea that the necromancer, if successful, becomes a lich, right? The necromancer becomes a lich, I would say. That is absolutely true. I mean, it doesn't mention it here, but it makes sense, right? Because a necromancer is a lich in training, you could say. Absolutely. The hallmark of a lich is that it has tethered its soul to the prime material plane. As a result, most liches retain much of the personality and even emotions that they had in life, at least at first. However, countless years of undeath caused memories to fade and the mind to twist. Eventually, a lich lost all shreds of its humanity. The state of existing as a lich is not a pleasant one, and a lich was able to maintain its existence only through sheer force of will. However, over time, this willpower warped into an obsessive drive to become more and more powerful. Many soon appeared borderline insane in their hunger to acquire arcane secrets. This fixation would often lead a lich to outright forget about its former life, and most liches reached a point at which they abandoned their real names in preference for ominous titles and pseudonyms. Perhaps because of this effort to bury their old identities, it was said that speaking a lich's true name could confer a power over it, and remainders of its past life were a good way to get its attention. Liches were often proud and arrogant, demanding the subservience of all those around them. Many were also cold and scheming. They cared only for their own affairs and paid little heed to the living unless their own activities were disrupted or some major event caught their attention. Contrary to popular belief, most did not have explicitly evil goals. Technically, a lich might ascribe to any alignment. However, because they are so completely detached from any sense of mortal morality, the living could not generally understand their actions as anything but pure evil. In very rare instances, truly good liches arose, which included those who had a more noble purpose for seeking lichdom, as well as those who had lichdom forced upon them. So that's interesting. I didn't realize that there was the potential for the Lich to be good. Very interesting indeed. I would say that if I were ever to become undead, I would aspire to be a Lich. If I was part of the undead roster, I'd want to be the Lich. And, you know, as I look at the books around me, maybe I'm already on my way there. Maybe I'm halfway there. okay, so let us have a look now at the final one. And that is, of course, the vampire lord. And as we've talked about already, they are also a top of the tree. They are also immortal. We know a lot of, I mean, I think we have a lot greater sense of the basic lore of vampires than we do of liches and some of the other creatures that we've looked at. Always noble, always have some sort of mansion, some sort of haunted house, very standard tropes, I would say, or, you know, some sort of estate, some sort of great family lineage, castle, you know. Now, since we've been talking about Warhammer, the Von Karsteins are obviously a great example, but there are many others as well, many others. What is of interest to me is the extent to which the the extent to which the vampire is connected with the rest of the undead army. And this, again, is ambiguous. Now, in the case of the Lich, we just heard that they're often very solitary in their pursuits. They're kind of scholarly. They're, you know, they're pursuing knowledge. They're obsessed with something, you know. And you can imagine that a Lich may recruit a few necromancers or whatever to put together an army for itself, or to put together, you know, for some sort of arcane purpose that they have. Okay. It's often not clear to me how the vampire goes about acquiring the undead army, what its relationship is, and how that comes about. Does anybody have any insights into what the connection is? How would a vampire go about, you know, acquiring necromancer followers? How would a vampire go about, you know, raising an army of skeletons and zombies and so on? How would a vampire, you know, be allied with a mummy? How does this come about, would one say? That is really a question. While you're pondering that, I will pull up D&D lore on vampire. I'm going with D&D because it strikes me that all of the other laws are basically some variant on this law, right? And the ultimate source, of course, of all of these things is mythology and culture, mythology and popular culture. For example, I didn't mention, for example, that the ultimate source of the white is Tolkien, as one example. So, you know, it comes in through various mythologies. Some people are saying it's actually the necromancers who seek out the vampires and not vice versa because they want protection. That makes sense. That makes sense, actually. And especially when it comes to the Warhammer setting, the vampire has got infrastructure. He may have like a fiefdom where he can collect taxes. You know, he may actually have a peasantry and a tax base. So there will come some benefits, I suppose, with being allied to a vampire. That makes sense. That makes sense. Let's have a little look at the monster manual. And I'll just show you that if you have a look at the artwork over the years, you can see directly how much of it is based on, like, I mean, that's just, you know, straight like out of Bram Stoker. That's, you know, Bela Lugosi, basically. You know, look, he's even got a mustache. and then, of course, you get, you know, more this sort of, I would say, the standard image of the fantasy vampire now is closer to this fifth edition variant than the kind of Bela Lugosi version, but they're all variations on a theme ultimately, aren't they? I mean, in Warhammer, they can actually do necromancy, that is true. But let us have a little read of the D&D vampire lore. Vampires were a type of undead that fed on blood. They were one of the most feared and powerful undead creatures. Okay. A vampire looked very much like it did when it was alive, but with paler skin, hardened and feral features, giving them a predatory aspect, and red eyes that were hard to forget. Their hands were clawed. They did not cast shadows and had no reflections in mirrors. Vampires enjoyed fine things, engaging in decadent behavior, sharing such habits with liches. A vampire was always a creature of evil. If it was not evil in life, it became so in undeath. That's an interesting thing. So that unlike the lich, who in theory can become good, the vampire is always evil. Vampire retain all the abilities it had in life, gain the ability to drain blood and life energy, and to dominate other creatures with its gaze. Yes, domination is a big part of the D&D vampire domination spell. Vampire could also command rats, bats, and wolves, or take the form of those creatures. The greatest weakness of the vampire kind was hypersensitivity to sunlight, garlic, steaks, you know, typical stuff. Vampires typically plotted to empower themselves and produce spawn that would spread across the world. And of course, you can create new vampires through draining the life out. And it actually distinguishes here between the master vampire and the kind of vampire minion. Because I like in Baldur's Gate, for example, there's the top, I forget her name now, like John Irenicus is number two, is a vampire, I forget her name. But there are also like vampire minions who are much more kind of feral, kind of tough battles, you know. And then there's the master vampire, who's much more of a kind of mastermind lord character. All right. So that is pretty much it in terms of the undead lore. We've just gone about 2 hours. Took a bit longer than I thought it would take. If anybody has any questions, I will endeavor to answer them, or anyone has any comments. In the Entropy Super Chats, Carl Habermas says, I will get a better suit. Zani Whoop says, I like the fact that zombies do not run around in the sunlight in D&D, and that zombieism is fairly hard to catch. But there are some uber zombie elite types like Z zombies. That's true. There is the Z zombie. Holocron Record says, now this is the type of autism I can get behind. Yeah, I'm hoping that for the people who are into this sort of stuff, this would be hyper enjoyable. And that's what I aim to do on Deepest Lore, really, is to have a space where we just kind of indulge this sort of stuff, free of anything. You know, if you're into wrestling, my wrestling Deepest Lores will be amazing. If you're not, on your bike, son, bus fare home, go and do something else. And this stream was very much the same thing for people who were into like fantasy stuff and RPGs and video games and so on. Okay. Let's have a look. Is there any other super chats? There's been one here. Boss Grand for $20. Well, thank you very much, sir. Says, great stream. Good to take a break from all the ills of the world. In Warcraft 3, the story of the Necromancer is a top-tier manipulator and is responsible for leading Arthas to be the Lich King. Only Necro I can think of as a lord. Yeah, but I'm trying to remember, like, in Warcraft, aren't they called Dreadlords or something in that game? The Dreadlord is a kind of vampire cipher in Warcraft. I mean, what was the name of that top tier guy who corrupted Arthas? What was the name of that? I don't know. Let me just have a look up Arthas Warcraft 3 lore. So yeah, if anybody ever made my, you know, my ideal game, we've gone through the standard. Okay, he's transformed into the Lich King. Okay, the Jailer. Yeah, who did he? Who was the neck? Oh, right, the Necromancer. Arthas became one of the most powerful and evil beings Azeroth would ever know. Although he killed the Necromancer Kel'Thuzad, Arthas was unable to stop the spread of the plague and resorted to increasingly desperate methods, such as purging the city of Stralholm. Taking up the cursed Runeblade Frostmourne, he was able to defeat the demon Mal'Ganis, where he lost his soul in the progress. Becoming a Death Knight of the Scourge, he led the undead in destroying various people. Okay, but who was the Necromancer who made him in the first place? Try to figure that out now. He became the first of the Lich King's Death Knights. He murdered his father to become the Death Knight. Says here he killed a necromancer called Kel'Thuzad. But you see, Kel'Thuzad, if it's him, wasn't a standard necromancer in that, was he? He was a lich, basically. He was a lich who majored in necromancy. And in fact, if you look at him, he's got like, he's also got a bit of Egyptian in him as well, by the looks of things. All right. Okay, so, Viking Molthal says, have you read any of the Warhammer 40K series? Super based. The Eye of Terror is great. It has a free audiobook of great quality on YouTube. I know Morgoth and Sargon are both Warhammer 40K fans. I haven't read that. I mean, I don't read any fantasy. I don't read any of the novels because they tend to be like tripe or whatever. But I'm into fantasy, not sci-fi stuff. Even though I've picked up a bit of 40K stuff here and there, kind of interesting. But I tend to veer on the fantasy side rather than on the sci-fi side. So I tend to kind of stay in there. Even high fantasy stuff I tend to like, but not novels, just like playing games and things and reading bits of lore here and there. Okay, thank you very much, everybody. I'm actually doing an outside appearance later on talking about Prophets of Doom with Poe the Person. And I will advertise that. I think that's at 8:15, 8:30. And I'll, when I have the link for that, I'll put it out on my community tab. So, catch that when you can. All right. Thank you very much, everybody. Now get out.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easy.